From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It's hard to imagine it now, but John Ronson points out in his new book that in the early days of Twitter, there were no public shamings. He says we were chatting, but being honest because these were strangers. After a while, though, we started using Twitter and other social media forums to take down the powerful and the stupid. And Ronson admits that this can be exhilarating, but somewhere along the line, we got nitpicky. It wasn't just transgressions that we attacked, it was misspeakings. And Ronson says it started to consume us. It stopped being like journalism or criticism. It felt like punishment. We had become a mob. Today in the program, John Ronson is joining us to talk about his book on public shaming, which is about the terror we all feel about being found out. Join us after the news. Hey there, podcast listener. This is Benjamin Bombard. I'm one of the producers of Radio West. Thanks for downloading this episode of the show. If you're a regular listener of the podcast, think about becoming a sustaining member of KUER. It's as little as $5 a month, and you can find out how to do that by visiting KUER.org. And thanks a bunch. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It's not hard to find the latest target of social media's collective outrage. There's a pattern to this, apparently, where someone does something, says something stupid, something reckless or racist or just clueless, and the rest of us are not having it. And so we call them out for it. And that's a good thing, right? It feels good to confront a bully or a bigot. The truth is, with the pace of the social media churn, we move on pretty quickly to the next fool. But what happens to the others we've shamed? Can we, should we ever let it go? Well, John Ronson has written a book that explores what happens to these people. He's interested in the consequences of our outrage and why we can be so brutal. His book is called So You've Been Publicly Shamed. Today in the program, we're rebroadcasting our conversation with John Ronson. In his book, he says, when shamings are delivered like remotely administered drone strikes, nobody needs to think about how ferocious our collective power might be. The snowflake, he writes, never needs to feel responsible for the avalanche. John Ronson is a journalist, a humorist. He's a contributor to the public radio program This American Life. His books include The Psychopath Test. We talked to him about that a few years ago. And he's joining us today from a studio in Boston. And John Ronson, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Doug, thank you very much for having me back.
Well, I guess I wanted to know, first of all, when did you first start thinking about writing a book about this? Or when did you first start getting, you know, kind of troubled by this shaming that you were seeing?
I mean, like everybody else, I was just shaming people online in the early days of social media because it kind of felt like a democratization of justice.
Yeah.
And I guess it just, you know, like a leveling of the playing field. You know, we had a voice. Everybody had a voice. And it was eloquent and it was powerful.
Yeah.
So when a newspaper transgressed, let's say a right-wing columnist wrote some racist or homophobic column, we could attack them with a weapon that we understood and they didn't, a social media shaming. And it was effective. It was powerful. I suppose the reason why I first thought I should write this book was because I began to realize that I would be feeling a little bit frustrated when a day would go by and there wasn't anybody to shame.
Yeah.
Like we'd fallen in love with it a little bit too much. Like a day without a shaming felt like a day picking fingernails. And coupled with the realization that, quite frankly, we were doing to other people the thing that we were most terrified might one day happen to us.
Mm.
Because we all feel we have bubbling away within us, you know, something that could ruin us if it got out. I just thought, you know, my goodness, something's really spiraled here. And what are we getting out of it?
Yeah.
And what consequences is happening? I have no idea. The people I've destroyed, not only could I quite remember who they were, what they did, but also, like, how are they? I don't know. I assume they're fine, but maybe they're not.
You know, one of the things that you write about is that this sense of, and we'll get back to this a little bit later, but this sense of fearfulness in how these, even these stories are reported. I mean, even in the articles that express the same kind of sentiment that you are in your book, like, wait a minute, maybe we've gone a little too far. Even there, you say they have these disclaimers, like, I am in no way defending what that person said. It's even in reporting it, you have to kind of attach that disclaimer because we don't really know what the reaction can be for ourselves.
Yeah, absolutely. We, on social media, we don't like to think that we are the powerful ones now because we still like to see ourselves as Rosa Parks walking to the front of the bus. You know, we like to see ourselves as the underdog, the plucky underdog, striking down people who are misusing their privilege. But really, we are the powerful ones now. If we say this person deserves to have their life ruined, if this person deserves to be fired, they get fired because social media said so. We have the power and we haven't caught up with the responsibility of our power. And you're right. There's one woman in my book called Justine Sacco who wrote this liberal joke that came out very badly. Going to Africa, hope I don't get AIDS, just kidding, I'm white. Yeah. And then she got on a plane and while she slept, her tweet went around the world and she was just destroyed. And you're right, like even the very, very few newspapers that had the courage to defend her, realising that she was trying to be like Colbert or trying to be like Randy Newman or South Park, just wasn't doing it well. In fact, I just found, can I read this from my book?
Of course.
So I found a writer from Variety, one of the very, very few people to stick their neck out and actually support Justine Sacco, who has been like ripped apart because of this joke. And he wrote, as vile as the sentiment she expressed was, there are some potential extenuating circumstances here that don't excuse her behaviour but might mitigate her misdeed somewhat. Repugnant as her joke was, there is a difference between outright hate speech and even the most ill-advised attempt at humour. You know, so what that reads to me is basically this Variety critic saying, please don't hurt me.
Right. Well, it's a massive, not that there's anything wrong with that. And it's interesting because, you know, from the Seinfeld episode, Justine Sacco's story, I mean, one thing she says to you, and we can talk a little bit more about her situation as we go, but she talks about the fact that it was a joke. It was a crummy joke. It didn't go over very well. She didn't deliver it very well. But she says this to you. She says, I'm not a character on South Park or a comedian, so I had no business commenting on the epidemic of AIDS in such a politically incorrect manner in a public platform, which is, it's such an interesting double standard. I mean, there are, Colbert can get away with it. South Park can get away with it. But Justine Sacco, how dare you?
Yeah. And I think she, I mean, it was a badly worded joke and it was offensive. But, you know, there's an enormous difference, obviously, between an intent to be racist and an intent to try and be like Trey Parker and Matt Stone.
Right.
There's a huge difference. It's all the difference in the world. And actually, I think Justine Sacco had every right to make that joke. It worries me a little bit or kind of saddens me when people say to me, I'm going to buy your book for my children so they think twice next time they press send on a joke that might be misconstrued.
Yeah.
Because that's not the message of my book. That's like saying, girls, it's Saturday night, don't wear short skirts.
Right.
You know, that's like victim blaming. I do want there to be some change in behaviour as a result of this book. And I believe there actually is a little bit of change. But it's not, you know, but the people who I'm hoping will change their behaviour. The people who gleefully and jubilantly tear somebody apart for a joke that lands badly. That's the behaviour that needs to change.
Yeah. Let's talk about Joan Allaire, because this is an amazing section in the book. Set this up for us, John Ronson. I'm imagining this is a public radio crowd, so most of us know who Joan Allaire is from Radio Lab and obviously from The New Yorker, but he has been publicly shamed, so I'm guessing everyone knows who he is. But just remind us really quick, if you would.
Okay, so he was a wunderkind pop neuroscience writer, got really successful really young.
Yeah.
You know, while still in his 20s, he had like a $2.25 million modernist masterpiece home in the Hollywood Hills, wrote books like Proust Was a Neuroscientist and Imagine How Creativity Works, which was, you know, a number one nonfiction bestseller.
Yeah.
And the first chapter of this book was called Bob Dylan's Brain, and it was about how Bob Dylan came to write Like a Rolling Stone. Anyway, a keen Dylanologist called Michael Moynihan, a blogger and journalist in New York City, was reading this and was like reading these Bob Dylan quotes and thinking they sounded a little bit fishy. So at one point, Bob Dylan is quoted as saying, whenever he reads about himself in the newspaper, he would say, "I'm glad I'm not me, I'm glad I'm not that." Now, those of us who've seen the Bob Dylan documentary Don't Look Back will recognise half of that quote.
Yeah.
Because Bob Dylan reads about himself in the newspaper, he smokes 80 a day, and Dylan looks up and says, "I'm glad I'm not me." But he doesn't say, "I'm glad I'm not that." So Michael Moynihan thought that's a little bit odd, and then noticed another five suspicious Dylan quotes and emailed Jonah Lehrer.
Right.
And this kind of reminds me a little bit of the movie Quiz Show, remember, with the kind of nebbishy John Turturro and the waspy Ralph Fiennes. So Jonah Lehrer writes this kind of snooty, slightly snooty email back saying, "I'm vacationing in Northern California, but basically my quotes are the accurate ones and it's history that's wrong." He was like a swan, I think, frantically paddling underneath because he's thinking, "Oh my God, I might have just been caught out, but I'm going to bluff my way out of it."
Yeah. And but Michael's like the cyborg in the Terminator. He keeps,
he keeps at it,
of course. And then there's this moment when, at first, Jonah figures, okay, he's not going to say anything. I think I've gotten past this. But of course, he's horrified when he realizes Michael is pursuing this, and he's going to reveal Jonah for this lie that he told, for his dissembling. And there's this conversation that you write about between Michael and Jonah, because you talk with them both. And it's just, I have to say, it's just heart-wrenching, because Jonah is basically begging Michael.
Yeah.
And he when he can't reach him, he keeps calling him. I mean, would you talk about that? Because it's just such an amazing scene.
Oh, it's so agonizing. I mean, I agonized about whether to put all of this stuff in, but then I thought, you know, it does the story a service to know the agony of what it is to be found out, but also the agony of what it is, funnily, to find somebody out. It's like these two men, neither one of them wanted this, but neither one of them could escape it. Michael had discovered that Jonah had elements of fraud in his story, and Jonah was begging him not to publish, like phoning 20 times a day, 25 times a day, "Please, please." And Michael said, it's like you're out in the woods hunting, and this feels great, and you've got the wind in your hair, and then you shoot the animal and it's lying there twitching on the floor, and suddenly it's not fun anymore, and you're like, I want to get out of here. But you have to shoot the animal in the head. That was the way Michael described it. And poor Michael and poor Jonah.
Yeah.
There was nothing Michael could do at this stage, because Jonah's agent, who's this incredibly powerful agent named Andrew Wiley, got somebody to call Michael to tell Michael to call him. Like a scene from The Godfather.
Yeah.
Is this enough to ruin a guy's life over? If you press send on this article, you will ruin a guy's life. And now Michael had to press send, because otherwise he'd be the so-called journalist who buckled to Andrew Wiley. He would be tainted and shamed by it. And so Jonah's like a kind of child's toy. This is how Michael described him, a child's toy, droning, "Please, please," you know, running out of batteries, "please." And Michael's out on the fire escape smoking, you know, carton after carton of cigarette. He says, "Jonah nearly killed me. I smoked so many cigarettes out on the fire escape." In fact, Michael said to me, "Have you ever been in a situation, you know, you've been a journalist for 30 years, have you ever been in a situation where if you pressed send, you would destroy somebody's life?" And I said, "I don't know." I suddenly thought, I don't know.
Yeah.
How many people had I condemned to this?
Yeah.
I felt so bad for Jonah, and I felt so bad for Michael. But Michael did press send. And he said to Jonah, I just want you to know I feel terrible about doing this. And Jonah said, you know what? I don't care how you feel.
Yeah. But you know what's so amazing about that is I still can't tell, even through after reading the story in your book, if Michael Moynihan regrets it or not. And because he said to you, he said, basically, if you ever have the chance to basically hold someone's life in your hand, where you, if you press send, you will destroy their career. He said, don't do it.
Don't do it.
And, but I can't tell, did he mean it or did he figure he did the right thing, but just really think about it before you do it?
Right. It's, you know, it's really hard. I think Michael is really conflicted about the whole thing. I think he feels guilt and also he's pleased because it was good journalism and his career got a little bit better. He got offered a job on The Daily Beast and he feels good about that and also bad about that. I think Michael is, you know, Jonah was horrendously traumatized by what had happened. I mean, when I met Jonah, I'm still the only writer to have met and interviewed Jonah. He looked crushed and broken and just full of shame and remorse. But I think Michael was kind of a little traumatized too by the whole thing. It was it was like two men in a car with failed brakes hurtling towards an ending.
There's this moment I want to play from. This is you reading from your book.
Yes.
It's one of these moments where one of the effects for Michael Moynihan was he said that people started to feel scared of him, and that there was this fear in the air that you know. And I want to play this section because he talks about here, he doesn't want to be in this position where he's trying to adjudicate everyone's ethical standards.
Right.
And then he becomes, as you'll hear in this reading from the book, it's like he became part of the mob. Here's John Ronson reading from his book, So You've Been Publicly Shamed.
Whether Michael liked it or not, there was fear in the air now because of what had happened to Jonah. But Michael didn't want to be some witch-finder general roaming the countryside with writers blurting out declarations of guilt to him, begging his forgiveness for crimes he hadn't known they'd committed. You turn around and you suddenly realise you're the head of a pitchfork mob, Michael said, and it's, what are these people doing here? Why are they acting like heathens? I don't want to be associated with this at all. I want to get out of here. It was horrible, I said. All this time I'd been thinking we were in the middle of some kind of idealistic reimagining of the justice system, but those people were so cold. The response to Jonah's apology had been brutal and confusing to me. It felt like the people on Twitter had been invited to be characters in a courtroom drama and had been allowed to choose their roles and had all gone for the part of the hanging judge. It was even worse than that. They'd all gone for the part of the people in the lithographs being ribald at whippings. I'm watching people stabbing and stabbing and stabbing Jonah, Michael said, and he's dead.
You know, we should explain that Jonah does make this public apology, and it's a disaster.
Such a disaster.
Go ahead.
Yeah, well, at a foundation called the Knight Foundation, he had the chance to make a public apology. But what he didn't realise until he turned up was that the foundation had put a giant screen Twitter feed right next to Jonah's head, so anybody watching from home could tweet their ongoing feelings about Jonah's attempts to get us to forgive him in real time, and the tweets would appear like right next to Jonah's head and cascaded into his eyeline. So while Jonah was trying to apologise for what he did, he would see tweets like Jonah Lehrer boring us into forgiving him, and Jonah Lehrer is just a frigging sociopath, and he is tainted as a writer forever. And this is as a man. Imagine that happening in a court. Mm-hmm. Imagine that happening during the sentencing hearing in a court with the jury going, you know, bored. That's what we did.
It's interesting. How do you describe your relationship with Jonah these days? I mean, there's this scene where you go on a hike with him when you're trying to talk him into, you know, talking to you for the book. It's almost like you became friends in some ways. I mean, he shared the speech that he was going to deliver at that John S. and James L. Knight Foundation thing. You told him it was fantastic.
And I wasn't sure.
Right.
It was like, well, I'm a bit ADD-ish, so I never know. Like when somebody sends me a big long speech, you know, my mind drifts. It was a very Jonah Lehrer type speech. He was trying to explain his flaws within the context of neuroscience. That, you know, that he succumbed to certain flaws that only smart people succumb to. And I honestly couldn't work out how this would play. Like, would it be like the end of The Jazz Singer when Neil Diamond reminds everybody how beautiful his singing voice is? Or, you know, the disgraced synagogue cantor? Or would it go down not quite so well? Yeah. Turned out it went down not quite so well.
At all.
It was like the worst apology speech in the history of apology speeches.
But he said something terribly to you that I thought was so interesting on this hike. He said that he felt intensely radioactive.
Yeah.
What did he mean?
Yeah, he said, I feel intensely radioactive, and even people who come to me with good intentions, my isotopes rub off on them. And I said, well, that's not going to happen to me. And he said, well, you'd be the first. And as he said this, a kind of bolt of panic shot through me. And I said to Jonah, what happened to you is my worst nightmare. And he said, yeah, and it was mine too. I think that really gets to the nub of what the whole book's about. And after the Jonah section, the people I meet are people much more from the kind of, you know, normal world, you know, care workers PR people and just regular people, software developers, who all, like Jonah, ended up, you know, shamed and disgraced and ruined because of, you know, something that happened on social media. But I think that part gets to really the nub of it, that when I was telling the Jonah story to somebody, he said to me, it's about the terror, isn't it? And I said, the terror of what? And he said, the terror of being found out. And I suddenly realized, oh my God, we are routinely, day after day after day, doing to people on social media this thing that we are most terrified might happen to us. Something so anxiety-inducing that, you know, the thought of it can mangle up your mental health, let alone the reality of it.
Here's another section from John Ronson's book, So You've Been Publicly Shamed.
Maybe our secret is actually nothing horrendous. Maybe nobody would even consider it a big deal if it was exposed. But we can't take that risk, so we keep it buried. Maybe it's a work in propriety. Or maybe it's just a feeling that at any moment we'll blurt something out during some important meeting that'll prove to everyone that we aren't proper professional people or in fact functional human beings. I think even in these days of significant oversharing, we keep this particular terror concealed, like people used to do with things like masturbation before everybody suddenly got blasé about it online. With masturbation, nobody cares, whereas our reputation, it's everything. I had leapt into the middle of the Michael Jonah story because I admired and identified with Michael. He personified citizen justice, whereas Jonah represented literary fraud in the pop science world. He made a fortune corrupting an already self-indulgent, bloated genre. I still admired Michael, but suddenly, when the theatre director said the words, the terror of being found out, I felt like a door had briefly opened before me, revealing some infinite horrorland filled with millions of scared, stiff Jonahs. How many people had I banished to that land during my 30 years of journalism? How truly nightmarish it must have been to be Jonah Lehrer.
John Ronson is with us. His book is called So You've Been Publicly Shamed. We need to take a brief break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. John Ronson has written an extraordinary book. A lot of you know John's work. He's been on This American Life a number of times. He's a tenacious journalist, but also, you know, quirky and funny, always surprisingly honest. John Stewart has called his work investigative satire. Well, John's new book is about what it's like to be publicly shamed on the internet. And you don't have to look far to find the latest person who's done something or said something really stupid. And then we go after them. We destroy them. This book is about what happens when you reduce people to the worst thing they've done. The book is called So You've Been Publicly Shamed. John is joining us from a studio in Boston. John Ronson, you write about in the book this the history of public shaming, which is amazing. Because all of this got you wondering what public shaming had, why it was phased out in the 19th century and how it worked, because it was, shaming was kind of a process for a time.
Yeah, exactly. In fact, I spent quite a lot of time up here in Boston at the Massachusetts Archives. I got really excited. I was, you know, going to see the very first court documents of America. And I got so excited and I went to the microfilm reader and started scrolling through. And actually, my excitement turned really to disappointment when I realized that for the first 100 years, all that actually happened in America was that people called Nathaniel bought land near rivers.
Right.
And also, nobody had invented paragraph breaks, as far as I could tell. And also a massive overuse of the letter F
right.
as well. I found it was really disappointing. But finally, I started to scroll through the microfilm reader, like really unprofessionally, with like decades passing in seconds. But then eventually I kind of found some very early public shamings. And the first one I found actually was a woman called Abigail Gilpin, whose husband at sea had been found in bed with a man called John Russell, and they were both going to be whipped 40 times. And she was appealing the whipping, but she wasn't appealing the actual whipping itself. She was begging the judge to let her be whipped in private, away from the public gaze. Please let me be whipped before the people awake. So it was the public nature of the punishment that terrified her more than the actual whipping itself. Mm. And time and again, that's what I found. It was like right from the very earliest days, the public nature of the punishments would be the things that were considered most brutal. So I found like the great thinkers of the 18th and 19th century just pleading, you know, like signers of the Declaration of Independence and so on, just pleading for an end to these public punishments because they were just so brutal, because the punishment far outweighed the crime. People in a crowd would just go crazy. And that's why they were phased out. We have brought back on social media something that was widely considered horrific by the great thinkers of the 18th century.
Mm. And
we don't realize that, you know, because we just want to, what we want to do in a perfect world, we would like to destroy people but not feel bad about it. So we demonize them. We say, oh, they were sociopaths. While Jonah tried to apologize in front of that live screen Twitter feed, people wrote, he's a sociopath.
Yeah.
You know, which is what we do to people we want to destroy, is that we reduce them to some kind of inhuman label. Or we say, oh, I'm sure they're fine. That you hear that quite a lot. Oh, that person we just destroyed, I'm sure they're fine. You know, we want to have our cake and eat it.
This was Sam Biddle told you that, basically. He's one of the journalists with Gawker. He's the guy that really got Justine Sacco's story going.
The woman with the AIDS tweet. I said to her, how did it feel to be at the forefront of that? And he said it felt delicious.
Yeah.
And I said, how do you think she is now? And he said, I'm sure she's fine. But she wasn't.
But this is really interesting, because you, at that point, you say in the book that it's our natural disposition as humans to kind of plod along until we get old, and then, you know, and then we die. But with social media, you say we've created this stage for this constant artificial high drama. Would you explain what you mean? Because you say this isn't really the way we naturally are as people.
Yeah, I mean, look at us. You know, when we're all in a room together, we're all perfectly nice to each other. And then put us on social media and we just destroy people. I mean, a really good example of this is something that happened this week. Trevor Noah, the Daily Show, Jon Stewart's replacement on The Daily Show. So at the beginning of the day, it was like this, you know, young South African, really funny, really edgy, mixed race guy is taken over from Jon Stewart. This is great. So he was like a hero. And then some people combed through his like 9,000 tweets and found five, you know, offensive, cringy tweets. And he went, you know, in the space of like an hour from being a magnificent hero to like a sickening villain. And people were defining him by these five tweets. So, you know, he shouldn't be taking over from this show. He didn't have, you know, he was worthless because of these five things he'd written. You know, what's going on there? And like everybody else, I'm like, oh, my God, those tweets are horrendous. Mm-hmm. But you forget what's going on there is that we are all desperately trying to define somebody by the worst thing that they ever did. We decontextualize these five crummy tweets. We ignore the 8,995 perfectly funny or innocuous tweets. And then we use these five tweets as like a clue to this person's inherent worthlessness or wickedness. But we know that's not true about human beings. We know that we're capable of good jokes and bad jokes, wisdom and stupidity, talents and sins, bravery and cowardice. You know, we know that about human beings. And the problem doing this, not only is it unfair to Trevor Noah and the countless people like Trevor Noah who are being defined by, you know, some bad phraseology from 6 years ago, the real problem it's something actually that a child therapist said to me in a signing queue a couple of days ago. She said that pretty much every child who comes to her now damaged is damaged because of something that happened on social media, because of this kind of surveillance society of high drama that we've created for each other.
What's the reaction you're getting? I'm guessing you kind of braced yourself. I mean, if it's any, are the comments we're getting so far, if they're any gauge, I'm sure you're getting some pushback. William writes, he's disappointed that you're trying to, as he put it, rehabilitate the image of Jonah Lehrer. Terry writes, why should I feel guilty for shaming someone who's an idiot in public? And Michael writes, publicly shaming bigots and hypocrites is what we should all do, and plenty of opportunities for it here in Utah. But what are the reaction you're getting, and how do you respond to that?
Well, can I take those three one by one?
Sure.
Okay, so the first one was, you know, that he's disappointed that I'm trying to rehabilitate Jonah Lehrer. I'm not. What I'm trying to do with Jonah Lehrer is humanize him without exonerating him. It does strike me as kind of weird that what I'm doing to Jonah Lehrer, I have done over 30 years to members of the Ku Klux Klan, mm-hmm. to Islamic fundamentalists, to white separatists. You know, this is what I do. I try and find the humanity in people. I try and understand the nuances of people. You know, even really, truly terrible people. You know, this is what I do. I de-demonize the demons. I try and demonstrize people. For some reason with Jonah Lehrer, you know, I'm not trying to exonerate him. I'm not trying to say that he didn't do things that were wrong. He's different to the other people in my book
yeah.
who were ruined yeah. for telling a joke that landed badly. But I make it really clear in the book that Jonah is very different to the other people in the book. Why am I not allowed to humanize Jonah? And why am I not allowed to make people feel what it feels like to be somebody like Jonah Lehrer at the moment of discovery? That feels like an honorable thing for a writer to do, to try and get inside the head of somebody who's transgressed and make the reader feel the agony that they're going through. Why am I not allowed to do it when it's Jonah Lehrer? I honestly don't get that criticism. Mm. If I was trying to say, oh, what Jonah Lehrer did was no big deal, it was the same as what Justine Sacco did. It was just, you know, the journalistic equivalent of a joke that landed badly.
Right.
I would be right to be criticised, but I'm not doing that. You know, I thought, you know, I'm not doing that. So,
and let me just say also, you're pretty, uh-huh. You break down what Jonah did. And not only that, even his book proposal, people have raised questions about whether he plagiarized Adam Gopnik in his book proposal, and you lay that out. So you don't really spare anything in terms of your criticism
of
Jonah
Lehrer. Yeah, I'm not defending Jonah Lehrer's transgressions, but I am humanizing Jonah Lehrer's behavior. And, you know, that feels like, unless I've really lost my marbles, that feels like a good thing for somebody to do, for a writer to do. The other one I remember of the three tweets that you read out, or the three comments, was, you know, why should I be, you know, why are we not allowed to attack bigots, and so on. Frankly, if Justin Sacco's AIDS tweet joke, going to Africa, hope I don't get AIDS, just kidding, I'm white, if that was intended to be racist, I wouldn't have put Justine in the book.
Right.
Because I feel like everybody does when it comes to racism and misogyny and homophobia. You know, I feel the same way. I think words have power. And I think it's, I think, you know, homophobia has diminished hugely in my lifetime. And it's partly because of use of language. So I feel the same way everybody does about that. But Justine's tweet wasn't intended to be racist. It was intended to be like a Randy Newman song or an episode of South Park. It was intended to be a kind of mockery of white privilege. So again, you know, that is something worth defending, right?
There's I want to ask you about Ted Poe. I loved this section
Ted
too.
Ted Poe's, such an interesting
story. Well, it was this, you had this certain assumption when you went to Washington, D.C. to talk about him. I mean, you sort of, I'm not sure if you saw him as this kind of ignorant hillbilly, but it wasn't far from that. He surprised you. Would you talk about Ted Poe?
Okay, so he's a judge who's really famous for sentencing people to very baroque punishments. So, for instance, he's the kind of guy who would, like if you've killed somebody drink driving, he'll pull you out of prison and instead of sticking you in prison would make you walk up and down a sidewalk wearing a placard that read, "I killed two people while driving drunk, you know, don't be like me or the same thing will happen to you." So when I went to see, you know, it was kind of early in my journey and I thought, God, who is this narcissist who's making people do this? And then I met Ted Poe and I met some of the people who Ted Poe had punished, you know, with these shaming penalties. Yeah. And I changed my mind completely. So the man who had to walk up and down the sidewalk wearing that placard, "I killed two people while driving drunk," he said, you know, he was terrified about this. What would passers-by do to him? What passers-by did to him was stop their cars and say, "Oh, I'm so sorry. Things will be okay. Come with me to church." And it was that empathy and kindness and compassion which was what saved this guy. And now he spends his life running a halfway house and lecturing in schools about the dangers of drink driving. And it was all because strangers pulled over and said to him, "Things will be okay. Things will be okay." On the internet, when we destroy somebody like Justine Sacco, or when everybody's tweeting as Jonah Lehrer is trying to apologize, "You're ruined forever. You know, forget about it. I will never believe you again." You know, there's nobody there saying, "Things will be okay."
Right.
You know, if we're serious about making the world a better place, you know, empirically, what saves and heals people and what puts people on the right path is empathy, kindness and compassion. It's not cold, hard judgment.
So interesting. Ted Poe said he hated the shaming that was going on in social media. I mean, here's a man who's imposing his own kind of public shaming, but he saw what was going on the internet and he didn't like that either.
Yeah, because it's frightening. I mean, social media is frightening. And of course, it's a good feeling to know that the playing field has been leveled out so that people like Ted Poe are frightened of people like us. I mean, that is a good feeling. And I'm not saying that ironically. I mean, just look at the I Can't Breathe protests, the Black Lives Matter protests. You know, that was all because of social media. The NYPD had a man in a chokehold and he said, "I can't breathe." And they ignored him and he died. There were protests organized on social media. The whole thing was because of social media and the protests were really successful. And, you know, this is very recently. And my guess, I mean, I'm not a member of the NYPD, but my guess is the next time they have somebody in a chokehold, they may think twice next time, you know, they start to squeeze.
Yeah.
You know, this stuff is great. You know, of course, only a crazy person would attack this kind of stuff. You know, and I'm not. I'm not attacking criticism. I'm not attacking social justice, journalism, curiosity, satire, citizen journalism. I'm attacking the disproportionate punishment of people who did almost nothing wrong. People like Justine Sacco and Lindsay Stone and many of the other people in my book. And that is happening every day. Now, people are being disproportionately punished, torn apart, their mental health mangled, and the people who are doing that are us, And that's what this book is about.
Well, that I think that's a really important point, this, the, your use of pronouns, because there's this moment in your conversation with Ted Poe where you say that you noticed that you had been using the word they. They're the worst. They're brutal. They're spineless. But you say you were realizing, you realized at some point you were using the wrong one, that it wasn't they, it was we.
Yeah, we. I mean, I've torn into, you know, all sorts of people, not in a kind of crazy extreme way, just like everybody else, just like, you know, many of the people listening to this. And the fact is, you know, what I wanted to do with this book is really describe, and I think it comes over in some of the excerpts that you've had. I wanted people to feel that terror, you know, to just feel what it feels like to be Justine Sacco waking up after sleeping for 11 hours on a plane to discover that 100,000 people have decided to ruin her life in every way that they possibly can, get her fired, get her stigmatized, and so on. I want to know, I want people to feel what it feels like. And I think my book is really a kind of page turner, and it's really anxiety inducing because people do feel that. And what I'm saying is, okay, now you know what it feels like. Yeah. You can make a more valued decision about whether to carry on doing it.
John Ronson is with us. His book is So You've Been Publicly Shamed. We need to take another quick break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. Back now with John Ronson. We're talking about his terrific book called So You've Been Publicly Shamed. He's joining us from a studio in Boston. There's a great section in the book where you basically explain how Google works because you've talked to this this company that helps, or tries anyway, to get people's reputations back, and that you have to kind of manipulate Google. Talk about that.
Yeah. So, okay, in the old days, the way that search engines worked were, you know, that if, you know, if a website just said John Ronson, John Ronson, John Ronson, just over and over again, it would be the number one search term for John Ronson. Now, if I came across a website that just said my name over and over again, it would be kind of exciting. But I think for everybody else, less so.
Right.
So what the Google people discovered was this thing called PageRank, which is basically a kind of popularity contest. So if lots of people are recommending that page, then it goes high in the algorithm. And, you know, if lots of people are recommending the people who are recommending that page, it goes even higher. So it's basically, I guess it's like how academia works, right? The more citations a paper has had, the more respected it is. So that's kind of what Google was trying to replicate, which of course seems a lot more sensible and it's a lot greater. But the problem is that it's so much easier then for somebody just to be defined. Like if we all decide to shame somebody, then that just shoots to the top, you know, there. I think if it really works well, like when somebody is being discussed over a long period of time. Mm-hmm. So like Obama, I think it kind of works well, like the consensus of Obama and what we like about him and what we don't like about him. You know, the Google search results pretty much reflect that well. Yeah. But if you're Justine Sacco, if you've just, you know, if you had no internet presence and then you get on the plane and you get off the other end and, you know, you've been destroyed, you know, that moment will, because of the way Google is set up, just swallow you up. So all these companies have been set up to try and get the bad thing that you did buried. And I sort of journeyed into that world of, you know, shadowy reputation management companies. And I hooked up with a company, one of the least shadowy ones out there, a company called Reputation.com. Yeah. I mean, the shadowy ones didn't want to talk to me because they were so shadowy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because they'd help, like, you know, paedophiles and murderers and so on. So obviously they didn't want me hanging around. But there's this company called Reputation.com who were much more ethical. And I convinced them to take a case on pro bono, this woman called Lindsay Stone, mm-hmm. who's this lovely woman who worked with adults with learning difficulties and made a joke that landed badly and was like completely destroyed by it. So they got their team, the kind of bespoke team onto Lindsay to try and rescue her reputation. And the way to do it was to set up blogs about how much Lindsay loves ice cream,
yeah,
and how much she loves cats,
yeah,
trips to the beach, Lady Gaga. And you know what, it works, but isn't it kind of sad that through all of this judgment and shaming and surveilling, we've created, you know, out of this Garden of Eden of the internet, we've created a world where the smartest way to survive is to be bland, just to talk about ice cream. Like, if you want to survive the internet, be bland.
The other thing is that that it costs hundreds of thousands of dollars to get your reputation fixed. I mean, it can be incredibly expensive.
So all of this time that we're thinking we're leveling the playing field and a democratization of justice, we're not changing that much, because the only people who can afford the services of reputation.com are the incredibly rich transgressors. Lindsay was really hard, because this photograph, I'll tell you very quickly what it was. Yeah. She would have this running joke of posing in front of signs and disobeying them, so loitering in front of a sign that said no loitering. I mean, just as a woman in her 20s, it was just a kind of silly, goofy joke. But anyway, she took the people in her care to Arlington on a trip to Washington, D.C., and they went to Arlington. And so she did this joke in front of the silence and respect sign. So there was a picture of her pretending to shout and flip the bird. So this photograph looked, on a superficial level, horrendous. It looked like she was flipping off military cemeteries. So no wonder, it went viral. And she was destroyed. She didn't leave home for a year and a half. Depression and insomnia and trauma. Nobody cared that it was just a joke about the sign. So I got reputation.com to help her, and they did. Yeah. And things are better. It doesn't mean I still support the aspect of the reputation management field, where serious transgressors are having their transgressions buried. But I think a lovely thing was done for Lindsay Stone.
Well, we don't have a lot of time to talk about this, but I just wanted to mention one of the questions came to you as you were thinking about this. Did Google, for example, make money on the destruction of Justine Sacco? So you went about kind of working this out, and they did, turns out.
Yeah.
A lot.
The figure I came to was that night that Justine Sacco was on the plane and destroyed and everybody was Googling her. In November 2013, Justine was Googled 40 times. In December 2013, which really meant between December the 20th and the end of December, because this tweet was written on December the 20th, she was Googled 1,220,000 times. So I spent a long time talking with economists about how much Google made out of it. And the conservative figure we came to, so pretty much the low-end figure, was that night Google made $120,000 out of the destruction of Justine Sacco. Whereas, of course, those of us who did the destroying, we made nothing and we got nothing. We're like kind of volunteer destroyers on behalf of Google's profit margin. Interns.
There's this section in the book where you write about, make this connection. Michael Furtick, he's reputation.com, person that you were mentioning. And he talks about how that, people who get caught up in this, like Lindsay and like Justine, they don't leave the house. They change their phone numbers. He says we're creating this culture where people feel constantly surveilled. More frightening, he said, than the NSA. And you mentioned that. You talk about the Stasi, for example, the East German secret police, and why it was so easy for them to get informants. And the conclusion of one of these psychologists with the Stasi said that it was this impulse to make sure your neighbor was doing the right thing. Is that the same impulse going on here?
Yeah, I think it's the desire to be good, empathetic people, to be kind of like Rosa Parks. Of course, we're forgetting the fact that what Rosa Parks did was courageous, and it's not courageous to tear somebody apart while she's asleep on a plane. But yeah, I think it's the desire to be empathetic is what's leading us all to commit these, horrendously unempathetic acts. I gave a talk before the book came out. I gave a talk in London where I compared Twitter to the Stasi, and somebody in the audience loudly tuttered. And I thought, the only reason why you're tutting is because you haven't thought it through. The Stasi was known to be the largest surveillance network in world history. Well, now the Stasi is the second largest surveillance network in world history. Mm. And while everybody's worried about the NSA spying on us, really, the people we should be worried about is the surveillance society that we've created for each other. spying on each other, making sure we're doing the right thing.
It's interesting. At the end of the book, you say that you don't take part, for the most part, in the public condemnation of people, only under certain circumstances, and generally like when there's an actual victim. And you say giving it up like that is kind of like when you became a vegetarian.
Yeah. I said I missed the steak, but not quite as much as I thought I'd missed the steak. But I just could no longer ignore the slaughterhouse. And, you know, this is really what I wanted to do with this book. I wanted people, and it worked, you know, people kind of have sort of, you know, their hearts pound when they read this book. It's, you know, it's still funny, like my other books, but it's kind of frightening and anxiety-inducing because I wanted people to go to the slaughterhouse. And that's what it feels like to read this book.
Final question. Do you think people will forgive Jonah and forgive Justine and forgive Lindsay? I mean, do we have it in us to forgive them?
I think with Justine and Lindsay, it's kind of already happened. You know, both of them have really benefited from this book and from the extracts. Like my book was extracted in the New York Times and it was the Justine story. And Justine got like so many emails saying, I'm so sorry for what those people did to you, as if they weren't half the ones doing it themselves.
Right.
And Justine emailed me to say, thank you. I'm so glad that you told my story, because, you know, there's nothing more traumatizing than being cast out. And there's nothing lovelier than being brought back in. And the same is true of Lindsay. Jonah Lehrer is obviously a different matter because, you know, he committed some proper journalistic transgressions. He played a kind of fraud on his readers. I would hope, because I want to live in a world where people get a second chance, I would hope he does get a second chance. And he has signed another book deal and he is bringing another book out. And I hope people give it the time of day, you know, assuming, of course, that he hasn't committed any of the same transgressions. And that isn't like some sort of judgment on the level of Jonah's transgression. You know, I feel that way about everybody. I think everybody should get a second chance.
John Ronson, this book is So You've Been Publicly Shamed. He joined us from a studio in Boston. John, good to talk to you again. Thank you very much.
Doug, it was such a pleasure talking to you again.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Braden Child. Technical direction from Tim Slover. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.